Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Dan Armstrong, author of the new novel Blake College from Mud City Press. Dan's work includes the novels Chain of Souls, Prairie Fire, Puddle of Love, Taming the Dragon, Cornelia, the First Woman of Rome, and The Eyes of Archimedes, a trilogy about the famous Greek mathematician and his slave during the rise of Rome circa 200 BC. Dan also has a short story collection called The Open Secret and 12 Tales of the Unknown, and he's published articles in The Register Guard, The Oregonian, Eugene Magazine, The North Coast Times Eagle, The Eugene Weekly, and Locally Grown. Dan makes his home in Eugene, Oregon, the setting for Blake College, where he runs Mud City Press, an independent publishing company, and online magazine. Dan Armstrong, welcome to KBOO.
Ken, thank you for having me here. It's always a pleasure to be on the radio, but to see you is very nice, and thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. Let's start off by talking about a great Portland-based writer whose work you very much admire, Ursula K. Le Guin. And actually, I think she sat in that very seat you're sitting in now. She's been interviewed many times on KBOO.
I'm honored, to be honest. I do love her.
On your Mud City Press website, there's a review you wrote back in 2007 on Le Guin's 1974 novel, The Dispossessed. You write, "This is a great book for its writing, its universal truths, its study of anarchism, and its analysis of the impact of human life on a planet. When read today, it seems remarkably current, touching with stunning insight on issues like climate change, natural resource depletion, sexuality, and alternative social models. From reading your new novel, Blake College, I would say that Le Guin's book was an inspiration." As context, can you tell us first a little bit about the book, The Dispossessed, and its impact on you?
Well, first thing I'd say about The Dispossessed is it's one of my favorite books, and it's easily my most favorite by Ursula. It's a very difficult book to read, and you covered some of the things that I felt were important, but the thing that I thought was most important about it and why I wanted to review it was her portrayal of anarchism as a government on a moon of the planet that's being discussed in the...
And you point out in the review that anarchy is not generally what we think of it as.
That's
you
exactly
know, the kind of chaos.
Right. You think of anarchy as chaos in the streets and nothing but people running around, maybe throwing torches or whatever.
Or rock through windows,
the anarchists
used to do
in Seattle
and Portland.
And when in fact, it's an entirely different system. And I'm not going to try to describe it the way she does, but it really is a working system. And I think that is, well, the most important part of the book to me is understanding that working system. Otherwise, the other things you commented about, the ecology of a planet as a whole and the relationship to the system that manages it is important. And I will also add, it's a very difficult, I think I said it's a difficult book to read, but it is very difficult. And I remember reading it the first time, struggling a little bit with it, but being engaged in it and coming in and out of it. And it's the only book I ever read where I started to read it again immediately upon finishing it.
Now, when did you read it? It came out in 1974.
So I did not read it till I think you said the review was 2007.
Wow.
I read it then.
A very different period. And the period that she wrote it in is really the setting of Blake College, which is why I asked, aside from some of the other issues that you share with her, not just anarchy, but also a love for the environment and a concern for what's happening to the earth. Of course, it's a lot worse now than when she was writing in the 70s. In that same review, you write that The Dispossessed is, quote, important and inspired writing, and in no small way a forward-looking sociological, political, and environmental statement born of the cultural revolutions of the 60s, which is a good transition to your book, Blake College. While Le Guin commented on the cultural revolution by creating her own worlds, you use the more down-to-earth setting of Eugene, Oregon in the 70s, early 70s. Why'd you choose that time and place rather than setting the story, say, in an alternate world like Le Guin?
Well, I would say I set it in that setting, one, because I knew it very well. The story takes place in 1970, and I moved to Eugene myself in 1973, and I knew it. So that was one of the reasons. Plus, this person that the story is dedicated to, his name is Sean. I won't say his last name, but he is one of the characters in the story under a different name.
And you won't tell us which character that is?
I will tell you, it's Tim O'Malley.
O'Malley. Who's somewhat an heroic figure.
Figure in the story, and he's one of my long-term friends. I've known him since the first year I moved to Eugene, so I've known him 45, 46 years.
Wow.
And I have always was impressed by him as an individual, the things that he did, his ethical code, his dedication to the community and doing things for other people. And to some extent, he was an inspiration for writing it because, one, he's a very colorful person, very imaginative. And I thought he really brought to life the mentality of that was going on in the streets of Eugene. In 1970, Eugene was not the only setting for the counterculture, but it was one of them.
And you actually mentioned some real world events that happened in Eugene, and they become part of the story, particularly several bombings on the University of Oregon campus.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And in particular, I picked that out because it was also a time when Eugene was going through its own internal changes other than the counterculture. It was rather than, I guess, the population of the Eugene-Springfield area now is about 180,000. In 1970, it was probably closer to 50 or 60,000, much smaller. And Eugene was also trying to get on the map. In particular, they were already famous for track. Bill Bowerman had been their track coach for 22 years.
And Bill Bowerman appears in the book under his own name, along with his protege. You might have heard of him, Phil Knight.
and I wanted to get that setting. I wanted the energy of Eugene. And we have these two forces coming together. One is the University of Oregon and the city and Bill Bowerman and the track team trying to make Eugene seem like an all-American city and the perfect place for the 1972 men's Olympic trials. This would put Eugene on the map. And at the same time, we have several bombings at the university and puts that in jeopardy. So I use that as a backdrop for what's going on. And in the story, although I label it on the back as sci-fi with a P-S-Y.
I was going to ask you about that, yes. And we'll get into some of the sci-fi with an S-C-I elements
right,
in the book,
right.
too, a little
and
later.
So I actually made the story very accurate as I could historically within the setting of what is a semi-believable plot.
And you used some actual places there. Well, I know you personally, so you met your first wife at a location that plays a big part in the book, and that's Max's Tavern.
That's exactly right.
Which, oddly enough, is also the inspiration for Moe's Tavern in The Simpsons, but it's still around.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I read that, but it's still around, and it was around back there in the early 70s, too. It's been an Eugene institution.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so I wanted it to be Eugene. And the thing that I really wanted, this really does touch base with Ursula Le Guin's story. And there's one factor is today there is a tremendous awareness for the environment, social concerns, women's rights, all of these things that are going on. And I won't even try to touch on them. But we think of ourselves as working on a sustainable future. Well, if you go back 50 years, that was what the counterculture was in 1970. And in the town of Eugene, and I imagine other towns in the United States, places like Boulder, certainly San Francisco, probably LA, but smaller places also, the counterculture was really truly trying to change the community in a much deeper way. Well, in a more active way. One thing I remember myself from being Eugene, and I came from the East Coast. I did not come from a particularly hip area, at least where I grew up. But there were many, many co-ops, you know, and this was this concern about what is capitalism, where does it lead us? And that was a significant part of the counterculture. and there were
communes.
All around Eugene.
Blake College itself, though, billed as an experimental college, is a commune in effect.
Yeah,
in the book.
It actually happened. Blake College was an event that actually happened in Eugene.
Now that I didn't know, because I looked up some of the events happened, some you made up, but I didn't realize Blake College. You mentioned a professor there. Did he actually start it?
The name is made up.
Okay, because I wasn't able to find him, Arthur Kottke.
No, that name was made up, and I generally the names are made up. I tried not to drag individuals in unless Bill Bowerman, president of the university.
Eugene Mayor Les Anderson, the university president Robert Clark, Phil Knight, we mentioned, even the legendary track star Steve Prefontaine makes a cameo appearance in the book.
And so they are real, but they are background characters. All the people that play four parts in the foreground of the story, they've been made up or their names changed. But that school did exist, and I have three friends who actually took part in it. So that was another part of my inspiration. But back to
took part in Blake College.
Took part in
was
Blake
it called
College.
Blake College? Did
yes.
you change? Oh,
yes.
I couldn't find anything about it.
Well, it was much as it is in the story. Mm-hmm. A professor at the university began this school as an alternative, I call it school without walls, and had failed after a couple of years. And he left the house. He
couldn't get it accredited.
He couldn't get it accredited. Right. And he also got frustrated. There's more to it than shows up in the story. But he had bought a big Victorian home near Skinner's Butte, and he had remodeled it and turned it into this little college, which wasn't going to have more than 15 or 20 people. And when it failed, he simply left Eugene and left the house empty. And at that point, several young hippies just moved in as...
And they were your models for the people who take it over in the book.
The people that actually did it are not my models. I changed the people because, the difference was they were squatting in this house. And the people that initially put it together did it more as a lark than I have the people in the story.
Who were a little more serious about it.
A little more serious about it.
But even so, between faculty and students, there were about eight people in the book, at least.
Yes, I think that number was about right. It was about equal students and equal faculty. And they did things like make granola to
sell at the farmer's market, the Saturday market.
To sell at the farmer's market and to make the school work.
Now, the fictional characters in the book, we talked a little bit about the real characters. So these fictional characters are the ones at the college. But it's a real cross-section of Eugene residents at the time. So we've got hippies, socialists, stoners. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. SDS activists, motorcycle gangs, including the gypsy...
Jokers.
The gypsy jokers and the free souls. The police are in there. A few police, Eugene policemen. Military vets just trying to make a living. Farmers and even a few timber barons, which plays a big part. I was going to ask, did you base these on people you knew? But you were saying at least in terms of the folks at Blake College in the book are different than the ones you knew who were at this experimental college in real life.
Many of the characters that you just mentioned are based on people that I knew that I changed for the sake of their privacy. And the reason, one of the things, I treated this book in the way that I imagine a novel should be. It's a novel, and I think in a novel, you want every character that shows up to have his own story, to have something going on in their life. They're not just stuck on the wall to pass through. And I wanted it to show Eugene as it was in 1970. There were, there's a lot of the characters were rural. A lot of the people there were rural people. There were farmers, and there were loggers, and there were hippies, and there were politicians. And I wanted
and
it all.
And there were conflicts based on that.
And I wanted all of that to show. I didn't want to just write a story about hippies or write a story about Bill Bowerman. I wanted the sense of it on the street and what it was really like, at least as I experienced it.
And you paint them actually as individuals. I mean, there's a motorcycle gang member who was a Vietnam vet, and he's anti-war, but he's also being pursued by this rival gang who
is not anti-war.
Yeah, who hates him more for being anti-war than being in a rival motorcycle gang. So there's a lot of characters in the book, and I found pretty much all of them, maybe with the exception of the Timber Baron, had three dimensions to him.
Right. I agree. Timber Baron is not developed as deeply as me.
And that might be my bias. You know, I have no reason to like people. He wasn't very likable in the book. Now, we mentioned a few of the real events. So what plays a big part of the book, the bombings by war protesters at U of O's Campbell Hall and Johnson Hall, that took place in 1970. And you also mentioned the city's quest to host the 72 Olympic track and field trials at Hayward Field. Very different events, but in the book, you actually tie them together into the plot. Was that a connection that was hinted at through your research or purely a fictional device?
I was a fictional device that I dreamed up. I believe it was probably going on, though. I mean, the situation...
It makes a lot of sense, and I don't know if we want to get too far into it.
No, I would just say I made that up, but it felt logical, and I wanted that extra, you know, I wanted a multi-level novel and things going on, lots of things going on. A lot of characters. I know that sometimes it's hard to keep track of a lot of characters when you're reading a book, but I tend to like to use a lot of characters and get a lot of engagement, mixing of them, people coming and going. So,
and you do kind of you alternate, so you'll have you know two or three characters, or in this case of the college, maybe eight, and then friends like Tim. He's got a friend Gino who's always hanging around with, and there's several other kind of tandems like that and subplots here. But I should mention that those actual events, the people who were responsible for them, are not the people responsible for them in the book.
And one thing that I did when I was doing this novel, I went to the Register Guard. And I remember I knew that before I started writing, I wanted to read as much of the Register Guard between the months of April 1970 and July 1972.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your research.
And so one Sunday night, I'm thinking, okay, tomorrow I'm going to Night Library. I'm going to go down in the basement and I'm going to start open up the microfiche. And if you've ever done that, it's extremely difficult to read. And you can get Xerox copies, but that's also a very difficult process. So I said, all right, I'm probably going to spend 3 months in the basement of Night Library. And then that evening, I said, you know, I'm just going to see what's online, just for the heck of it. Well, it turns out that Google has scanned almost all of the newspapers in the United States.
What's not online?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, for me, it was
amazing.
Massive.
Yes.
And that meant I could read every issue online at my home. I didn't need to use microfiche. I could magnify it. I could save pieces of it. Rather than 3 months, which is what I thought it might take me, I believe it took me 3 weeks.
To do the research.
To read. I read the headlines of every paper.
Of the Register Guard.
Did
you look at the student newspaper? That's the Daily Emerald there, too?
I didn't go to the Emerald. You know, that would have been the way to go, and I didn't even check to see if that was online. But I was getting – I had the advantage of knowing many people that took part. And as the man I mentioned before who's dedicated, Sean, he was really one of the leaders of the counterculture in that period of time, and he was looked up to. He was very young. He was 21 when I met him, and in the book, he's 22. But a very young man who really knew what he was doing, and I got a lot of the story from him.
So the research was not only these newspaper journalistic accounts, but also these personal accounts.
Right.
Now,
like I said, I knew many of the people. I knew the people that started Blake College. There's, you know, if you pick out even... the character you mentioned, Gino, he's a person that's a real friend of mine.
Oh, he was a very vivid character for me, is what I would say. Yeah, he really came to life on the page.
That's nice to hear.
And somewhat comic.
And I actually wrote the piece with the intention of making it humorous. And I think it's more serious than... I think you can read it as a serious piece,
I do, but I regard him as a comic. He was light. He lightened up the mood.
But there's a little bit of humor, a lot of ironic humor going on, particularly with the FBI.
There's kind of a slapstick scene with the FBI where and Gino gets some revenge on him.
So even that, Ken, the FBI scenes, and even as slapstick as it was, those were real. As it turns out.
Really? So I should mention to listeners that there's a scene where, actually a big part of the book, there's FBI undercover. They open up a bike shop and they're there to spy on the counterculture to determine who did the bombings, who was responsible. Gino finds them out and laces their food at, Max's Tavern?
Max's Tavern.
With a little acid that he gets, and hilarity ensues.
So that part is made up. However, that they were there and that the methods they use, including Polaroid cameras, which comes up in the story, is real because my friend, as I said, Sean, many years ago, through the Freedom of Information Act, he had his FBI file released. And he has 500 pages on him. And I went through it with him. And we picked out some of the funniest stuff that was going on and real. And we
The perspective of the FBI agents following him or writing
him
about
him. And even reading the FBI reports is actually more hysterical than maybe the novel, because they're just going, this can't be. They couldn't have been this.
And possibly less credible. Huh?
They couldn't be less credible. Right. Anyway, yeah, so... even that was real. And, like I say, it's the book is more real than not real. Certain parts are certainly not real.
Well, let's talk about the less real parts of the book. We started our conversation talking about Ursula K. Le Guin, and she's known, of course, for her fantasy and science fiction novels. Your book, with its setting, a number of real people and events that we talked about, the time and place, Eugene in the early 70s, seems like it would be straight literary realism. However, there's an element of science fiction and the supernatural that actually plays a very big part in the story. I'm not sure how much you want to give away, because this is revealed later in the book, but can you talk about why you went in that direction?
Okay, yeah. No, and you're right. The big first, I don't know, I think it's 180 or 90, 200 pages, do read kind of like a realistic attempt to describe life on the streets of Eugene, and not only that, city life, and Bill Bowerman. And many of the people, as they're reading it, I've been told midway, saying, oh, Dan, this really sounds like Eugene. It's pretty fun. And then midway through, I throw a serious curve. And I did that I don't want to give away what goes on, but I'll touch base on it. I had always wondered, in that era particularly, there was a lot of New Age mysticism going on. There'd be astrology.
Of course,
or
yes.
People throwing tarot, reading tarot cards, or doing tarot sticks with the I Ching. I mean, and there was this sense of maybe, I don't know, mystic existence. I mean, I'm really not coming up the right word, but maybe an expansion of our spiritual senses, mm-hmm. You know.
Kind of exploring the unknown.
Exploring the unknown. And I always wondered if somebody sat down in a seance, and for the most part, you know, you see them on TV or a movie, that people sit down in a seance and they invoke the spirit world. And, you know, in my own life, I probably have tried that a few times, but I never remember really making contact with the dead. So I wondered what it would mean if some young collection of hippies got together and they went through this process and something happened. And that's what I wanted to do. As a matter of fact, if you lived in Eugene at that time, or even when I got there a couple of years later, if you were young and wandering around the neighborhood, you know, you might pedal your bicycle up to some house that was being inhabited by eight friends of yours, you know, in a communal situation. And the night before, by chance, they had maybe gotten very high in some variety or another and stumbled onto some thing that they thought was, conspiracy or grander than they are. And that sort of stuff happened all the time. Now, invariably, they turned out to be, you know, maybe just an unusual night. Mm-hmm. Nothing came of it. But I wanted to play with the idea if something came of it.
And that was the objective of some of the drug taking. I wouldn't say all of it, but maybe a big part.
I think people, yes.
And you even have an epigraph. The one I wanted you to read is not the one I'm referring to, though. The one I'm referring to is a very famous one from William Blake, who the college was named after.
Oh, right, right.
If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man, and you put and woman, as it is infinite. Now, the other epigraph, I wonder if you would read for us. That's one I had not heard before. C.W. Ledbetter from his book, The Astral Plane.
All right. So C.W. Ledbetter is part of the Theosophical Society from the
turn
of the century.
Oh, from Blavatsky.
Blavatsky. He has written a book called The Astral Plane. And in the beginning, he opens up and he says, though for the most part entirely unconscious of it, we pass the whole of our lives in the midst of a vast and populous unseen world. During sleep or in a trance, when the insistent physical senses are for the time being in abeyance, this other world is to some extent open to us. And we will sometimes bring back from those conditions more or less vague memories of what we have seen and heard there. So,
and you play on those vague memories,
and
which
I play on those
turned
vague
out to be
memories.
More than memories.
Turned
but
out to be more
but
than
again, we don't want to give away too much. Yeah, it's an important turn in the book coming about halfway through.
Yeah, about halfway through. So.
Now, the sci-fi and supernatural elements, which we're not going to talk about much further, act as a warning to us about environmental destruction. What happens when our world can no longer sustain new life? So I want to quote again from your review of The Dispossessed, and this is a character in the book. You're quoting Kang, and Kang says, "My world, my earth, is a ruin, a planet spoiled by the human species. We multiplied and gobbled and fought until there was nothing left, and then we died. We controlled neither appetite nor violence. We did not adapt. We destroyed ourselves, but we destroyed the world first. There are no forests left on my earth. The air is gray. The sky is gray. It is always hot." From an environmental standpoint, especially regarding climate change, things are much worse today than when Le Guin wrote those words. Was that part of the context for Blake College? I know you do a lot of environmental work.
Yes, yeah. And I didn't play it up too much in, well, there's a little bit that Blake College does. One of the teachers there is a wildcrafter, so she takes the students out into the forest and teaches about relationships of natural plants that you can eat and how you might want to wildcraft them in a way that they sustain. In other words, you don't want to go out and pick every one of the mushrooms or every one of whatever you're picking up. You want to make it so it continues to grow. So that, and yeah, that's definitely environmentalism. I mean, alternative energy, co-ops, all of the things that we still think of today occasionally and are still meaningful. We were, again, talking about 50 years ago. And in a sense, 50 years ago, we were making more use of them. Now, I haven't been in every city all around the world, but or around the United States even. But at that one time in the Eugene, they had a cooperative garbage company. They had 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 cooperative homes in the neighborhoods that act as growers, bulk food collecting locations.
And the food co-ops.
And the food co-ops. There's the People's Cafe, which later became Mama's Home Fried Truck Stop. There was a cooperative tree planting group, the Hodads. As a matter of fact,
they make an appearance in the book.
make an appearance in the book. And, you know, we don't see so much of that today. Occasionally you do. And I mean, in Eugene, it still exists, but not like it was. It was the true undercurrent. And in a sense, as I think I suggest in the book, they almost create a alternative economic system. In other words, they're growing organic food. This is really the organic movement started about 1970. Well, it started before 1970, but as a popular movement, it began to happen. And, you know, really things were happening and percolating. And part of why I wrote this book is I wanted people to remember that we've been here before. And we paid some attention, and then we kind of lost track, it seems. And we've come back, and hopefully it'll take more deeper, a deeper root now. We don't really see that.
And
happening.
Maybe we can avoid that fate that the characters
see on another planet.
Another planet. I actually saw some parallels between The Dispossessed and
right. No, I
but,
mean,
but again, based on those supernatural science fiction elements.
So one piece that I wanted to bring up when you asked me to come here and talk about the book is one of my own pet, I won't call it a peeve, but it's the meaning of the word hippie.
So it's derogatory now.
Well, that's what I was getting. That's where I'm headed, you know. And so when it comes up, people use it as a derogatory term. And in my own case, I was definitely counterculture a large part of my life. And I actually consider myself to still be part of that. My lifestyle is very much a countercultural, and I consider myself a hippie still, though my hair is not very long. But I've run into so many people saying, referring to hippies as you would, and I don't want to make a derogatory comment about some other group of people, but you know, basically bums are basically doing nothing, ne'er-do-wells, hanging out, smoking dope, and doing nothing. But the truth of it is, there's also a good connotation from hippie, and that was the counterculture. And that's what I wanted to portray in this story, is these people, yes, maybe they were smoking marijuana, maybe they were taking LSD, whatever they might be doing. But if you got to the core, and not everybody was taking drugs just because they had long hair, a lot of the people were focusing on a new way to live. And I believe that's where I grew up out of. I was 20, 21 years old, and I believe that that's where my values came about, you know, how they were instigated. I was young. Maybe I got caught up in propaganda. Today, I believe I got caught up in what was a very meaningful movement. And that was another part of trying to do this story.
Do you still find people like yourself who may have been very young during that time, trying to live according to those principles?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, and it's there's a different extent.
Especially in Eugene.
Well, in Eugene, there's still a heavy countercultural population. The community still has quite a bit of it. I don't think it's more around the environment than it was about the economics. I think in the 70s, the economics of it, and the co-op, and the working together, and the idea of the community was huger, was larger, more important. Today, the environmental issues and also certainly civil rights, women's rights particularly. But if you remember, Ken, in the story, I talk about the fact that Eugene in 1970s was really a magnet for free-spirited women. And it was the beginning of feminism. And if you lived in Eugene in 1970s and you had come from someplace else, you were completely amazed by the part that women were playing in that community.
And you have characters at Blake College who come from other parts of the country who experience that.
Right, exactly.
Some with not the best results. And
well, you know, again, the idea is that everything isn't good.
Right.
Some things.
No, I like that part, that you know, it wasn't all this utopia.
Right. Even some of the good people have their flaws, and I think that's the way we all are.
Now, you run, I mentioned in the intro, the independent Mud City Press, and you publish your books through Mud City. What are the advantages of publishing your own books rather than going through the bigger publisher, and some of the drawbacks? I would guess some of the drawbacks, marketing, promotion, distribution.
There are it's a good question, Ken. On one hand, I also publish other people's books. If you go to Mud City Press, you'll notice most of the novels that are books that are on sale there are ones that I've written, but I've also have begun to pick up other people's books.
There's at least two that I saw in there that
actually
by other authors.
Authors, and one author has done three books, although they're not three books through Mud City Press. They don't all show up on the internet, I mean on the website. But one book is called Botanical Treasures. It's actually a collection of plant profiles. Mud City Press is at least half dedicated to the environment. Quite a bit of it is about what is the sustainability, what's the capacity and the resilience of the Willamette Valley with the potential of major changes. I mean, I've done a lot of agricultural work in the Willamette Valley, but the other part is the books, and that's what I've focused on the last few years. So what is good about being your own publisher? It means that I can publish any book I want. I can censor it in the way that I like. If you looked at my titles, you'd say, well, most writers today are told, you know, find a genre, find a niche, and perfect it. And I think that's good advice. And also write about what you know. That's, again, good advice. Well, I haven't followed any of that advice. And if you look at the titles, I've written four that are set in ancient Rome. I've wrote two environmental novels, one set in China, one set in the United States. One is set in China. I mean, India. I've done, let's say, science fiction. I've done Cornelia is straight historical fiction, almost nothing made up. Others I've played with much more. But I haven't created what we will call a niche. And but I don't have anybody telling me I have to stay there. So that's nice.
I guess writers are told now to create a brand.
Create a brand. Well, maybe I'm creating a brand, but no one could possibly label it other than with my name. But the drawbacks are primarily distribution and getting word out. An opportunity to come on to KBOO like today is really hugely beneficial to me. I will probably speak to many billions of listeners today, I'm sure, and they'll hear about this. But getting word out is hard. I do a lot of book festivals.
I've noticed that.
And that's one way
to
sell books.
In Eugene and in Portland. In fact, when we had you on the show, I think a year or two ago, it was for a book fair here.
In Portland, right. And, you know, it's difficult. I do some advertising, but I've discovered I break even on my advertising. If I put ads in magazines that fit into what I'm writing, it's been difficult. I one thing that's going on, and I think it's important to note, I do use Amazon. I use CreateSpace as my publishing platform. And without any argument, I know that there are good environmental arguments against Amazon. There are good arguments on an economic scale about Amazon.
There's a very famous Ursula Le Guin speech that was somewhat negative about Amazon.
Oh, I didn't hear that. But
yeah, it was at National Book Awards.
Oh, well, I mean, I understand that. Uh-huh. And I sometimes, well, people will ask me, you know, how are you doing the books? And when I say, well, I'm using Amazon's CreateSpace as a platform, you know, I'll get some negativity. And
it's a difficult dilemma for every author I've spoken to. The Amazon versus going the independent route. It's hard to avoid Amazon in terms of selling books.
It is. And so I will say, I do feel the negative. I am not really a fan of Amazon. However, the platform they give to an individual writer like myself is really pretty marvelous in that I can do these books for so little amount of money. The overhead for publishing a book through Amazon is less than $100. And if you do all of the work yourself, I do all the formatting, all of the graphic arts, I do the covers, it gets very cheap to do. And if you're an independent writer like myself, that enables me to actually make a profit. I do not make a lot of money selling books, but I do make some. And it's mostly because my platform's overhead is so low, and I've learned how to do some of the technical aspects of it.
And in many ways, it's taken away that kind of a hold on the writing market by the big publishers.
Well,
they don't like what you wrote, or if they don't think it's going to sell, it never sees the light of day.
But and that's it's not become true now. Harder. So, Ken, that right. was part of it. You know, I've known you, I don't know, 35 years possibly. And there was a time when we were both discussing these things. How do we get writing into print? How do we get connected with the big publishing house? And I've had an agent for a while. I don't have one now, but I went through a lot of that, a lot of sending manuscripts in. And it's gotten harder and harder with every year because the publishing business is not really doing that well. We have the internet competing with it.
Oh, no. And in fact, their promotion is way down too. A lot of writers who publish with the big people in New York still have to go out and make their own do their own marketing, make their own appearances, schedule them, hire a publicist, which
no,
the publisher doesn't
exactly
do.
That's exactly right. And I've run into that. I was talking to an agent and he was interested in some of the stuff I was doing. He says, well, what do we need to do? He says, well, start a website, and start publicizing yourself. And I'm going, wait, well, that's what I'm already doing. So I think the name helps you. If you've got Random House on your book, that gives you a certain amount of standing in the writing or literary field. And it's it is helpful to have a publishing company. I would love to have a big company behind me. But as you say, not every publisher is given really that much help. And I actually can publish and sell my books cheaper. You know, I can get a book published and printed for $7, and I can sell it for $15. And it's a book that might be 400 pages long. You're going to have to pay $30 from another publisher. So
it's a good thing for the reader,
too. It's a good thing for the reader. And anyway, Amazon also gives you a platform to sell. If you want to do a Kindle, they will do that for free. So all of the books that are on the website, and including Blake College, are already available in Kindles, and they're, again, also relatively cheap. And if you often, a customer will come up and say, Dan, what's the best way to buy a book from you? Where do you make the most money? Well, I usually say, I just want readers. I'm not so worried about getting the money because I'm not going to get wealthy doing this. However, if you buy a Kindle, I make more money on that Kindle than I do on a hard copy. And it doesn't take up paper. And I don't even have to touch it. I don't have to send it. I don't have to see it.
Right.
It just goes straight through. So, and they do the hard copies that way also, although I do sell them off my website. I always keep a collection of all the novels at home, and I have access through the website to buy them directly from me. Again, I make a little bit more money that way. But again, to me, Amazon is a good and bad. I definitely recognize the negative, but it can be very helpful to starving artist.
Now, one more question, and let's get back to your own work here. We mentioned some of the previous novels. There were four. There was the trilogy, and then the one that also took place in Rome. So going back about 2,000 years, Blake College projects us 2,000 years into the future. What's next? Another historical novel? Place? Time? Do you have all that settled?
I finished this book a month ago.
Okay, I should let you get some sleep.
But I'm already begun another book, and it's a book that is set in 1900 in Vienna. And
Freud in there?
Sigmund Freud is one of the characters in the book.
Maybe Carl Jung?
Carl Jung is not there yet. Okay. It's a little before him. I have been researching this book for 10 years, so I've already read and made notes. I've done character sketches of everyone that's in it. I've probably written 3 or 4 chapters. And currently I'm rereading all of my notes and all the books. However, without going into much detail, one of Sigmund Freud's most famous cases is the case of Dora. It's called the analysis of, a fragment of the analysis of a case of hysteria. And in this story, this is such a fantastic piece. You're going to have to stop me at some point, but it's very relevant. It fits the Me Too era perfectly. When Sigmund Freud, and I'll make this quick, in 1890, Sigmund Freud was just setting out as a psychoanalyst. I think he'd been in business for 4 years, something like that. He had developed his sexual theories, and one of them was called the seduction theory. And most of the people that he analyzed as in his early career were women, mostly young women, and they were all given to him as hysterical. And that meant, sometimes they might have a somatic symptom. Maybe they limped or something, but they really didn't have a bad leg.
And of course, that word has a physiological origin.
It has a physiological origin with the uterus.
Right.
It goes back to probably Aristotle. But in any case, at one point, after analyzing several of these young women and as early in his career, he began to believe that many of these women were suffering from these symptoms because they had been molested by someone in their family, maybe a brother, an uncle, a father, something that, again, we know about today. So then, in the course of the next 10 years, and culminating with this case of Dora, he changed this, and he concluded that all of these stories that he would hear from these young women were fantasies, and that none of it happened.
Oh, my.
So this...
What a turnaround, huh?
Huge turnaround. And then from 1900 till 1960s, that was the basic premise of all psychoanalysts.
He was onto something and then just kind of negated it.
He negated it. Well, yes. And I get into that, into the novel a little bit. I haven't written it yet, so I don't know how far I can go. But the bottom line is a decision that Sigmund Freud made in the 1890s made it so that when a young woman went to a counselor or a psychologist, of any case, psychiatrist, and told her that her brother had seduced her or her father or her uncle, it was written off almost without any discussion as fantasy in the back of the mind of this analyst. In the 1960s and 70s, however, this broke open, and several women psychologists began to realize that how many instances of young women saying they'd been seduced by their father or brother or something like that, and they were discovering that it was true. So in many ways, that's what's drawn me to the story. I'd like to get into this back and forth with Sigmund Freud and with the analysis of the family that this young Dora came from. I won't go any further. It's complex, but it's important. And like I say, I wrote four novels in ancient Rome, all relatively serious, hardcore reading, ancient text, Livy, Polybius, Plutarch, anybody I could find. And then when I was done with Cornelia, which I say is easily my most serious book I've ever done, I said, you know, I want to write something where I'm a little more fun. I get to make up some stuff.
And that's Blake College.
And that's Blake College.
Well, we look forward to the new book, too.
Give me about 18 months.
I'm not going to rush you.
Thank you.
Well, Dan Armstrong, again, thanks so much for talking with us today on KBOO.
Well, Ken, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure and pretty much fun, too.
We've been talking with Dan Armstrong, author of the new novel Blake College from Mud City Press. You can learn more about Dan and his work at mudcitypress.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Dan for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.